casi medio siglo de confrontación armada.
Vamos bien en Cuba, en nuestras conversaciones con las FARC. Vamos bien, con dificultades de todo tipo, porque reconciliar después de 60 años a un grupo que ha estado en lo que ha estado, y con unas condiciones que sabemos nosotros perfectamente cuáles son las líneas rojas, donde no podemos pasar. Pero si hay voluntad, yo tengo fe que este año vamos a lograr la paz de este país.
Por otro lado, Iván Márquez, jefe de los negociadores de las FARC, en los diálogos de paz, resaltó también el buen momento por el cual atraviesa el acuerdo entre este grupo guerrillero y el gobierno sobre el tema acceso, uso y distribución de tierras.
Creo que, como en ningún otro momento, sentimos las dos partes que avanzamos en la construcción de un acuerdo en torno a un tema que es importantísimo, el del acceso y uso a la tierra, como lo hemos explicado también en declaraciones públicas conjuntas, en torno a la conformación de un fondo de tierras, de donde se tomarán los elementos que sean necesarios, concretamente la tierra, que será tenida en cuenta para la distribución gratuita a los campesinos sin tierra. Bueno, estamos trabajando en ese sentido, ¿no? Y las cosas van por buen camino, es lo único que yo puedo decir, ¿no?
Cabe indicar que en medio de este diálogo por la paz aún se espera la liberación de dos policías y un militar que están en el poder de las FARC hace más de una semana. Según indicaron los voceros de la guerrilla, para dejar libres a estas personas antes el gobierno debe dar las garantías del caso. Para ello, además, se pide la participación del Comité Internacional de la Cruz Roja y de la Organización Colombianos y Colombianas por la Paz.
Hemos llegado al final de otra edición del Informativo Pacífica. A nombre del director del proyecto, Fernando Velázquez, se despide Norma Martínez.
Este y otros programas del Informativo Pacífica pueden ser escuchados o descargados en iPad o en forma tradicional en kpfk.org en los archivos de audio.
And coming up next on Free Radio, it's your old favorite, Bathroom Spears Broadsides. That's me, and perhaps you. Stay tuned.
news on TV.
And that was Ani DiFranco from her album. The song is the same as the name of the album, Red Letter Year. And you can hear most of the lyrics, but just for kicks, I'll read some of them. Maybe all of them if my voice holds out. I'm having some health problems here, but I'm here, faithful to you listeners. Red Letter Year. New Year's Eve, we dropped mushrooms and danced around the house, making music with everything that we found. Incantation replaced resolution, and we vowed to allow each perfection that we could be, and the goddess has sent word that this would be a red-letter year. They didn't mention how much shit was going to change around here. It's just as well we weren't swollen with unfocused dread. We had visions of sugar plums dancing in our heads, dancing in our heads. First you go under, and then coming up gives you the bends. When you break the surface, all you can see is your friends. So you grab your purple crayon and flesh out the picture behind, and finally the whole world is made up of one unbroken line, one unbroken line. When you wake up sick as a dog with dull eyes and really bad hair, standing under a lit sign with the words on air and the water is rising, it's coming in everywhere. Just remember, you are there. You are always, always there. And representing the white race, a man with a monkey for a face is flying over in a helicopter, whistling Dixie and playing dumb in a town that might put a gun to your throat or rip the roof right off your place. There's a mold crawling up the walls and falling asleep in your lungs. And you and I both know how to drink, so we will always have work in this town. And besides, the police are stationed at the bridge, and they're preventing passage to higher ground. So let's pull up a bar stool and get ourselves a ringside seat. For one unnerving moment, they're going to show the truth on TV. Again, Red Letter Year, Ani DiFranco. And I'm going to play another tune, and I'll be back. You are tuned to Free Radio 101.1. Well, actually, it's now 101.3. And you can also find us at freakradio.org, clicking on the red dot in the middle of the transmitter icon if you go there. Stay tuned. And that was another one from Ani DiFranco's same album, and that was called All of This. Lyrics were, I will not stand immersed in this ultra-violent curse. I won't let you make a tool of me. I will keep my mind and body free. Bye-bye, minutia of the day-to-day dreams. I'm expanding exponentially. I am consciousness without identity. I am many things, made of everything. But I will not be your bankroll. I won't idle in your drive-through. I won't watch your electric sideshow. I got better places to go. I will maintain the truth I knew naturally as a child. I won't forfeit my creativity to a world that's all laid out for me. I'll look at everything around me, and I will vow to bear in mind that all of this was just someone's idea. It could just as well be mine. I am many things, made of everything, but I will not be your bankroll. I won't idle in your drive-thru. I won't join your electric sideshow. I got better places to go. I won't rent you my time. I won't sell you my brain. I won't pray to a male god, because that would be insane. And I can't support the troops, because every last one of them is being duped. And I will not rest a wink until the women have regrouped. That's All of This from Ani DiFranco's Red Letter Year. So, welcome to Bathrop Spears Broadsides. I go till 8. Uncle Dennis then comes trooping in. And you can be on the show, too. Phone number is 427-3772, area code 831. Phone calls are always welcome, and I think I've actually got operational phone lines. I got a phone call a moment ago, so it actually works. I've got some interviews to play. I've got a lot of clippings that I would like to read if my voice holds out, but it's kind of weak tonight. I'm, as I said before, struggling with a cold. But, I'll do what I can. But that means you have to call in. Now's your opportunity to beat me down or to speak up, because I'm somewhat less energetic than usual. Plus, I'm recovering from a dental appointment that happened about an hour ago, so half my mouth is somewhere else. But let's hear an interview. Well, it's a street moment with Hutch.
So it's around 25 to noon.
Morning, Robert.
Hey, man. Now I'm walking up the streets, passing the coffee roasting company.
Hi, Robert.
Greetings.
How you doing?
So it's getting close to noon. I'm down here in front of Betty's Eat-In on Pacific, keeping an eye on Officer Azua, who is standing near the corner of Soquel and Pacific in front of...
Hutch will be coming shortly. Don't dismay. But this is a little bit before Hutch.
Forever 21. No one is seated anywhere along that storefront, which is a little unusual, either on the sidewalk or close to the building. So I'm kind of curious. I guess maybe Azua has been assigned to stand there and keep an eye. There is a guy across the street in a red hoodie sitting on the sidewalk in front of Gap, who is... I think he has a small sign, you're beautiful, and he may be seeking spare change. I'm not sure. And the weather is pleasant, not too hot, not too cold, a little bright for my hypersensitive eyes, but people are smiling as they walk by. It's not necessarily the most usual thing in Santa Cruz. And generally the street is not entirely depopulated of homeless people, but there is a significant absence there. There's one guy sitting in his backpack over near the close to the silver shop on the corner of Walnut and Pacific. And there are a few people chatting on the street. Artist Freeman is sitting up close to the coffee roasting company. No musicians yet on the street. And considering the weather, that's a little strange. The weather is so beautiful.
talking with Robert Hutchinson, Naval Aviation Airman.
Hutch, what you got?
I got a ticket yesterday because I sit out on the ground. I got a ticket.
Where were you sitting on the ground?
Right over there.
You're pointing across the street, which is next to near the next space?
Yes, and the officer says, what are you doing? I said, I'm sitting here drinking my soup. He said, what were you smoking earlier? I said, a cigar, man. What the hell are you talking about? You're a rookie or what, man? Come on. I said, well, you write me a ticket. I'll sign it there and go on your way. So he did. So my attorney said, just give me your tickets. I'll take care of it.
Who is your attorney?
Arthur Dudley. Good man. Best one.
I see you're smoking now. You're off Pacific Avenue on the one remaining bench in this to be four bench area.
I've been smoking a cigarette.
And I don't think it's illegal to smoke on a bench.
It's okay right now. Yeah, they took that one out. This one's still here.
They took the two across the street out,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, I know. They don't want us. Then they give you a ticket if you sit on the ground.
Well, they don't need your kind. What you got to do is go to one of the local cafes and pay $2.50.
What hurt me about that officer gave me a ticket. I gave him my phone number, my address, where I was living. He put transient on there, and I'm not transient. I got money. I pay rent.
Could it be he was, shall we say, profiling you, stereotyping?
He was profiling me, yeah. He knows me now. He won't bother me. He said, calm down. I said, I am. You calm down, man. Just write your ticket and go on your way. Have a nice day, sir. Thank you. He'll never make sergeant lieutenant.
I'm afraid that that's, unfortunately, the wave of the future is that kind of shit. This people outside of this next space group are...
There's people like you and me, good people around it. They love us. We love them.
I don't know if I love them. Speak for yourself. I think that there is a gentrification.
They love me more on
gentrification. They're trying to change the quality of the town, and it's...
Well, they got the best people, me and you guys like us.
They're not if they can drive you away with tickets.
Well, they're not going to drive me away. They ain't going to drive me away. I'll get the tickets to my attorney.
Well, maybe you'll die off and go. I think that's their hope.
Well, yeah, eventually. But in the meantime, I'll just sign your tickets and wish them a nice time.
We've been talking with...
Robert Hutchinson, Jr.
Thank you, Hutch.
And you're Robert Norris, right?
That's me. I'm Robert. Not for broadcast, not...
Yeah, we have the occasional not-for-broadcast interruption there, but I got a lot of stuff for broadcast, if I can get to it. How about another musical break, briefly, while we make sure everything is okie-dokie? And again, phone lines are open, 427-3772. Before I move to the music, just a couple of things I want to kind of update. I'm probably going to be playing during the second hour something that some of you may have heard last night if you're regular listeners to Free Radio. It's John Malkin's show. He has a Wednesday evening show, The Great Leap Forward, and I believe an hour of that show is taken up with a Santa Cruz 11 series of interviews. He was going to write an article for the Good Times, but apparently they couldn't find space for it. And so it's not going to be happening, which is too bad, because John wrote a great article this last summer, which was reprinted in Street Spirit, originally appeared in Good Times, about the Santa Cruz 11. So that should be coming up around 7. It'll probably give me an opportunity to leave early and collapse in a heap before I collapse on the floor. So that should be interesting, and I actually haven't even heard those interviews. One of them is with me, one with Becky Johnson, and one with Brent Adams, or Big Drum Brent, as I've called him before. Beggar Backer Becky, and of course, Bathrobe Spear Robert, if I were to use the funny names that I occasionally throw at people, including myself. So that should be coming up. Also, hoping to play shortly an interview with Steve Schnarr, who is an activist with the Bike Church. And he, as you may know, as a regular listener, I'm pretty sure you've heard plenty of this, has been trying to get the SCPD to resume its delivery of bikes to nonprofits, which used to be done via the Bike Church. But apparently, the police department, either through pressure from the city council, conservatives, or some other group, it's not clear, changed this policy and redirected bikes to the Bike Dojo, which, as far as I know, has not yet set up a distribution to nonprofits, though it's had that opportunity for almost a year now. And they are they face some criticism from folks who are concerned about the distribution of bikes to low-income people, which has obviously suffered something of a slowdown. The Bike Church did get one shipment of bikes from Watsonville because the Bike Dojo apparently couldn't distribute them all, gave them to its some sister organization in Watsonville, and then gave them back to the Bike Church. It's kind of funny. And it got me interested because Mayor Hillary Bryant seemed to have been involved in this. She has connections with the Bike Dojo, and there was some question as to whether there was either, if not funny business, at least some sort of something she would know about going on. And I did talk to her a week ago, as I mentioned on the air, at a Monday interview. And she, the issue became, you know, let's see some of your old emails on this issue. They were requested by Steve Schnarr. They were not provided. And I then asked her to provide them. She said she already had. Steve hadn't received them. I sent her an email today saying, come on, let's get with it. It's a city council member, you know, it's a public business. People make a Public Records Act request about you and the public. Your responsibility is to provide the emails. And I haven't heard back from her yet, but again, it's only been a day. But in a certain sense, it's been like 5 months, because my original emails to her were back in September, and she essentially ducked the issue after a brief reply. She, last week, when she finally met with me after repeated requests, she said that she would get me the emails, and I haven't gotten them yet, and I'm hoping still to get them. The emails may mean nothing, but what does mean something is that city council members who promise to do something do it, and city council members remain transparent to some extent. That is to say that they follow, and I don't know if it's actually the law in terms of making their emails public. I think that they can still get around that, but they shouldn't be. The public should not allow them to get around that kind of stuff. Because if it's about the community has a right to know what's going on, particularly if powerful people are lobbying the city council. The city council is not supposed to be having private asides with those people, particularly if there are written communications back and forth. So, I'm attempting to make sure that happens. And anyway, I'm going to be playing an interview I had with Steve a week ago on the subject, which essentially said he hadn't gotten anything yet from Hillary Bryant or from Tina Shule, who's the assistant city manager who's supposed to be working on the whole procedure to re-allow the Bike Church or some organization to be able to distribute to nonprofits. When I put the same question to Councilmember Micah Posner, or Poser, no, I don't want to say that. Let's not be mean. Our new council member, he said he couldn't talk about it. He wasn't responsible to the community, just to the Bike Church, and it was a big secret thing until he got it worked on. It was just a rough draft, blah, 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 blah. So I haven't heard anything more. And Steve himself may be shutting down on this issue, too. I've requested to see a copy of the rough draft of the agreement that they're planning because, you know, if they got an agreement, that's fine. But we're talking a year later. You know, I mean, come on. Some people apparently want to wait forever in the hope that, you know, power and authority will throw them a bone. But often that just doesn't work that way. You have to present some sort of countervailing power, as I've often said. So, well, that's sort of a small update. I have a few other updates, which I will pass on here. Keith McHenry, the co-founder of Food Not Bombs, has agreed to come on the air on Sunday. He sometimes forgets, spaces out, or gets preempted. Or something else preempts us, I should say. He is in California, and he will be coming to Santa Cruz, hopefully, if that can be arranged. I think it's already been working. It's being worked on behind the scenes. He gave a great speech at a benefit for the Santa Cruz 11 last year, and hopefully it'll do the same, because four of them are still going to trial, being falsely charged with crimes for a peaceful occupation of a vacant bank building owned by Barry Swinson and leased to the infamous Wells Fargo bankster gang that is, of course, reaping in profits of plenty at your expense and mine, and foreclosing when it chooses. Pretty notorious group. Anyway, Keith should be on the air on Sunday. My show runs 9:30 to 1 on that day. I don't know exactly when he's coming on, but he did say he was coming on. I also spoke with the attorney, Diana Valancourt, who was instrumental, or certainly a part of the legal team that secured the city of Sparks versus White federal court ruling, which said you are allowed to put little price tags on your artwork, if I understand it properly, and that emboldened Robin, a local artist, as I've mentioned before, to go to John Barrisoni and say, hey, police are harassing me for putting prices on my artwork, and this court decision makes it quite clear. Ninth Circuit Court covers, I don't know, what, 9 or 10 states in the West. You know, we're one of those states. So Barrisoni agreed that he would do that, and he would also, he would advise the police department that, you know, it was legal process to put price tags on artwork. Now, this might not apply to jewelry, it might not apply to other stuff you're vending, but if it's your direct artwork and has some free speech, clear involvement, it doesn't have to be an explicit political, philosophical message, but it has to be an expression kind of well, a First Amendment expression of a kind, and that means not something that's merely done for commercial purposes, as I understand it. But Barrisoni failed to write that into law, and apparently the police department is in its usual creeping fascisti approach, let's say creeping attempt to control the downtown area more tightly. Let's not sully our dialogue with old words like fascist and so forth. But the increased militarization, the increased restrictions, the increased power of the police to intervene wherever and whenever it chooses, particularly against poor and homeless people or street people or performers, artists, political activists, is a matter of concern, as regular listeners know. So what Diana told me was that the court decision is still current, and I sent an email to John Barrisoni just to ask him what his current status, what the current situation was on this, and I'll read you what I wrote him. I don't think I've got a reply back, but again, you know, this is all just done today, so I'm not trying to impugn poor John for not getting back to me. Let's see. Here we go. What I wrote to him was this. John Barrisoni, who is our city attorney. You may remember Robin coming in to secure an agreement from you that he could resume displaying his artwork on the sidewalk without a permit and without harassment from the SCPD, even though he attached price tags. This was several years ago in response to the city of Sparks versus White. And then I give him a website where he can find that decision. He told me that you and he made such an agreement. Several artists have told me that the hosts and the Santa Cruz Police Department officers have been telling them they'll be cited if they do what you apparently okayed for Robin. I know Robin also requested an explicit change in the law, and to my knowledge, and his, you never recommended or created it. I want to know if you've changed your position here and now regard artwork as not First Amendment protected as far as explicit pricing goes. What is the current policy and direction to the SCPD? This clarification is particularly important because some police officers are not merely banning explicit pricing, but also claiming that showing artwork without a business license is panhandling, even if it's done for donation in accord with the explicit exemption of the panhandling law, which states, quote, a person is not, repeat, not soliciting for purposes of this chapter when he or she passively displays a sign or places a collection container on the sidewalk pursuant to which he or she receives monetary offerings in appreciation for his or her original artwork. or for entertainment or a street performance he or she provides. Please let me know what the status of the White decision is regarding city policy, as well as assurance that Municipal Code 9.10.010A is still active law. That's the exemption I just read. Hope you are well, Robert. Nothing yet from our own city attorney. I did get a reply from Robin, to whom I CC'd the letter, and he said, that's a good letter, and I hope it gets a satisfactory answer. Keep me posted. So I'm glad I'm not misrepresenting Robin. I'm glad he's looked it over and given his, stamp of approval, it sounds like. I've also been investigating whether there's been missing video, again, still missing from the Santa Cruz 11 cases, even though I'm no longer charged with felonies and misdemeanors and all kinds of other ridiculous charges for reporting on it being a part of a protest last November and at the Wells Fargo Bank with some folks who were with Occupy Santa Cruz and other groups. I'm still concerned about the fate of the four Santa Cruz 11 who are still part of that frame-up, because that's really what it is. It's a political frame-up. And I'm concerned that it's already been clear that Rebecca Young, the DA who's been prosecuting these charges under the orders from her boss, Bob Lee, presumably, has withheld evidence repeatedly in violation of court orders, and actually got the DA's office got fined $500 for it, an unprecedented move. I wish it was stronger, but, you know, that was the best we could get from Judge Burdick, apparently. But I'm wondering where the video is that shows the police essentially beating people up, and that's not the right word, hitting people with their batons in front of the bank building. And I know that this happened to a couple people, both from secondhand report, mostly. I think I may have seen one or two instances, too. It may have been justified. You know, I mean, there was a large crowd of people there. Police felt anxious and nervous, and, you know, they felt they were trying to protect Wells Fargo's interests. After all, they are the Wells Fargo police. But I'd like to see the video about it, if it exists, and I'm still trying to track it down. It supposedly was given to us last August, and indeed, I got an email from Brent Adams, who's one of the four still accused. He says he thinks he has seen that video, and I may be able to, if not describe it to you, see it myself and comment on it later. And I think the whole process of how the police have treated. Police and authorities have treated homeless people, activists, the Occupy folks, the Santa Cruz 11, is really quite a grim story that is kind of parallel with what's happening on the national scene. I mean, there's been a lot of controversy this week on Amy Goodman's Democracy Now! It was mentioned, and it's all even hit some of the papers in different ways, about Obama's assassination memos, where he's allowed to... He gave out his justification for, or his underlings gave out their legal justification for killing anyone at any time, anywhere, whether they're an American citizen or not, if he finds they are associated with Al-Qaeda in a leadership position or an allied group, without charges, without trial, without any transparency. A number of authors have written about this. Glenn Greenwald has written a long article. Others have written articles. Even one of my conservative relatives, who's normally a faithful Obama Democrat, has emailed me back that he's made a little nervous by this. and he's not even Islamic. So, and he's not obviously, he's a man, a lot of people tend to support Obama because the alternative would be worse, is what you always hear, even if Obama is the more effective alternative, who is making it worse, regardless. And I think this is reflected locally, was reflected locally last year by the police agency's activities, by the authorities handing down a series of unprecedented curfews. Began with Peace Camp 2010, probably began long before that, but it was emphatically underlined by the fact that in order to crush a protest that was simply trying to alert the community to the fact that there is no legal place for homeless people to go, and at night they face these $150, $160, $170 citations for sleeping. They can't sleep together in groups. They can't sleep in well-lighted areas. I feel like an answering machine with this sort of same message all the time, but it's true every night. And there's space for 5%, 10% of the homeless population in shelters. Not the best shelters either, but there obviously could be campgrounds. There could be a suspension of the sleeping ban in some areas, considering the freezing cold. People need to stay together to protect each other. But there isn't. Instead, there's increased harassment under this latest needle hysteria that I've talked about and you've seen on the headlines of the Sentinel, where a few needles become the basis, a relatively few needles. I mean, there are some needles. They found needles, yes. Maybe even as many as 100 needles in the last couple weeks. But considering that there are tens of thousands of needles out there, in the sense that those are the ones that are distributed, it's a drop in the bucket, and it becomes the basis for smearing, needle users, for one thing, and also homeless people who are out there, and they may have particular problems disposing of their needles safely. And what do the authorities do? They ban needle exchange in a place where it's needed, in the lower ocean. Not on the basis of stats showing increased crime, but on the basis of Take Back Santa Cruz and other groups screaming about needles and homeless camps and illegal behavior and drug tolerance. It's essentially an ideological maneuver. And even see Don Miller, who's the editor of the Sentinel, came out with a long editorial about it. Admittedly, he's been robbed 3 times apparently, and he's not happy with that. But he ends up the editorial, enough is enough. But enough what? You know, I mean, if you want to change, stop drug addicts from breaking into your house, I keep going back to the solution that Deputy Chief Martinez rejects and tries to quote an authority. I played him an interview I had with him last week, earlier actually, this week. It was on Sunday I played it. In which he says that, he rejects medicalization as a solution, which is to say providing needles and injection rooms and inhalation rooms for those who want to, smoke crack or whatever, places where they can safely engage in their addictions without, one, burdening the legal system, frightening the horses and the children, stealing from their neighbors in order to get the money to buy stuff that's, incredibly expensive because it's black market material, and then preoccupy the law enforcement authorities. It's just ridiculous. And I would have thought this would have been obvious from alcohol prohibition, and I'm a broken record on this, and you've heard it so many times. But, you hear Steve Clark, who's another one of these deputy chiefs, coming out with this line about the, I'm trying to remember exactly his quote around the lower ocean stuff, criminalization. And it's not really about personalities, but you do have to hold individuals who are in positions of power and authority responsible for what they say. There is a general undertow backward in this community that's going on now. And I haven't yet seen the online agenda. Perhaps I'll be able to take a look at it and give you some thoughts for the next city council meeting, which is Tuesday. But I am afraid that they are going to be going after folks, creating new laws to criminalize poor people, triple fine zones for open container and things of that sort. Again, I haven't seen these laws. I've just seen the recommendations of the public, misnamed Public Safety Committee. But I want to take a look at that. So why don't I do that? Take a peek. And while I do that, Here's a singer who will entertain you. That was Ani DiFranco, and yet another of her red letter year, actually, not red letter day, sorry, red letter year songs. It was called Present Infant, and it was, those lyrics were kind of audible, so I'm not going to read them. There is a city council agenda online for the Tuesday City Council meeting, and the City Council's Public Safety Committee recommendations are on the agenda. So, that's not good. But the recommendations, it's a little unclear what they're actually going to be recommending. Before I get into that, though, I noticed there's also something on the agenda for the Punish the Panhandlers meter, or Starve Out the Spare Changers meters, those big red meters you see downtown where people are supposed to give to the bureaucrats so they can decide, you know, what money should go to whom, and that will discourage giving money directly to people who are looking for change for clothing, food, or drugs, whatever they're looking for money. It's part of this perennial shopping effort to clear away poor people in the middle of an ongoing economic crisis that impacts particularly those who haven't got any money. Anyway, this is a motion to accept a change in the Imagine Positive Change program. 20 years ago, they called it a hand up, not a hand out. There are all these different little cute phrases they use, which essentially are, screw the First Amendment, we want to stop you from giving money away, you know, fuck your attempt to be compassionate, we want your bucks from the stores. And that has always rubbed me the wrong way, as you can kind of imagine. They want to hand over the Imagine's Positive Change Program management to Project Connect. I think it's being done now. Maybe it's being done by the Downtown Association. I'm not sure. The background is, in April of 2010, City Council approved the installation of 8 parking meters for Imagine Positive Change to provide a donation point for individuals who wish to help those in need and decrease the negative effect of panhandling. The Downtown Association was administering the program for the first year on behalf of business leaders, service providers, and neighborhood representatives who supported the parking meter collections program to fund the services of the downtown outreach worker. It's not clear how much money they got out of this. I think I put in a Public Records Act request and didn't get a clear answer for some reason. DTA, the Downtown Association, was responsible for it. And so now they installed the meters, were unable to realize the full objectives of public awareness, education, and sponsorship, you know, hanging every third panhandler. The working group intended to have the meters sponsored by businesses as an additional source of revenue, which would also be beneficial in terms of maintenance, educational campaign to learn about the program. Many of the meters were vandalized, and broken, and repairs were not undertaken timely. Upon evaluation, it became apparent the aforementioned objectives have not been successfully accomplished. This is what we would have told them in the first place, I think. And it was proposed that the organization Project Homeless Connect steward the Imagine Positive Change program. Project Homeless Connect, you may remember, is the kind of once or twice a year deal that does have, opportunity for homeless services. I think they've done it at the Civic Auditorium for 2 or 3 years running. Don Lane has been a big advocate of it. Free meal for that day. You can get assistance with legal matters. You can get haircuts. You can get a birth certificate. All kinds of stuff on that one day. Right. So, it's, to me, I've always regarded it as a kind of a obnoxious PR promotion for the homeless services groups, which aren't really providing the basic services of shelter or stopping the criminalization of the poor who are trying to shelter themselves where they can. But on that day, they provide something. But this is an attempt to... I think it will degrade Project Homeless Connect insofar as it does do a positive thing once or twice a year, in providing, an opportunity for people to get together, talk, even though you are essentially serving as shills for a bunch of paid service providers who aren't providing, as I said, the most essential service, shelter. So they want to give it to Project Homeless Connect to direct this, really obnoxious and insulting panhandling meter program, which really, first of all, attempts to preempt the judgment of shoppers, and secondly, attempts to direct them to be less generous and less compassionate toward people that they see and believe and come to understand are in need out there on the streets, in order to stop them from... they claim they're doing it, of course, for their own good, using drugs and all that sort of thing. There are plenty of reasons people need money who are poor out there that have nothing to do with addictions. And indeed, some people do need money. I mean, they do have addictions. Sorry, that's just where it's at. And the notion these are all sort of chosen things, and it's just a lifestyle they've chosen. This is the sort of the favorite phrase of the bitter enders who are in Take Back Santa Cruz, who want to drive these folks out of town. Criminalize folks seriously, cut back services to poor and homeless people. Anyway, the city has engaged I'm reading from the report. The city has engaged only preliminarily the concept of this early stage and the challenges. They want to put this there's a the question of they want to put this under the Art Commission. Have local artists repaint the meter heads, stylishly modifying them. Currently, the heads are painted glossy red. They're going to pretty this up. It's sort of like, you know, prettying up the batons that the police are carrying around, or, you know, prettying up your tax return as it, you know, your income tax demand. Tax return, I guess, would be nice to get back, but prettying up, you know, your tickets they give you, they put on your cars. I mean, it's really kind of, it's stupid, insulting, and kind of desperate in a way. Anyway, this is on the city council agenda for next Tuesday, and I guess I'll, assuming I have any voice left, I'll be talking about it again briefly, maybe more knowledgeably on Sunday. The other thing on the agenda that I originally mentioned, which, you know, is perhaps more to the point, which I've been more concerned about, are these public safety recommendations. There are six of them, but the only thing that they're giving here are the same staff report that came to the public safety committee 2 weeks ago, and I don't think there have been any modifications. I don't think there was any modifications. It was just sort of rushed right forward by the Public Safety Committee. I'm looking to see what it is, and well, maybe there have been some changes. There's a motion to convene a citizen task force to examine public safety issues, sunset in 6 months. Two council members designated by the mayor that will report back to the city council. There's discussions with the city, Santa Cruz County Health Services, volunteer needle exchange programs to develop best practices for hypodermic needle dispensing. This is a sort of a nice cover for what they're really doing behind the scenes, which is restricting needle exchange and crushing the one residential needle exchange outlet that they had in the South of Ocean area right across from the Beach Flats, which have been apparently successful for 20 years, 10 years, I'm not sure how many years, but a number of years. And there was no indication that there were a lot of needles found in that area or that there was a lot of crime in that area. Just anecdotal claims by a few people. A full room came and denounced a needle exchange, some of it organized by some groups of the special agenda, and I think there's nothing wrong with some of these groups have the agenda of cleaning up the city, which is a good idea, putting in more public restrooms, which the city council still is refusing to do, but now it's going to study it. It's going to have to study it to find out whether it should be done. But again, there were no stats that showed that this should be closed down. And instead, this is going to be, they're going to have continued discussions with the city. And they turned over needle exchange from the voluntary group to the county health, which is, according to activist Steve Plaich, who was very dismayed by the whole process. So dismayed, he didn't really want to even talk about it at the last Occupy meeting that we had. We were trying to get together a resolution and some kind of response. And we still are, I think, a lot of us. This is something, you know, it will mean increased police surveillance. It is not going to be increased needle exchange. It's going to increase needle disposal in unsafe ways. And that, of course, will perpetuate the impression that the city is a city of great tolerance because they're trying to engage in harm reduction, which is part of this right-wing mythology that we are in the midst of. So, the other recommendations are, let's see, committee recommends a model of hypodermic needle exchange, require a one-for-one exchange for needles in coordination with the Santa Cruz County Human Services Agency. And I haven't heard a good debate on this issue, really, from both sides. I've heard people suggest that, you know, the current situation is fine. I've heard others suggest that it's a scandal. I've heard people suggest that there are problems, but they're exaggerated. I really need to see hear a good debate on this. Consider options to provide additional public sanitation facilities. Well, you build them, you know. You build a 24-hour bathroom. What kind of options do you need? You know, let's talk about it for another 10 years. pursue partnerships with nonprofit and community organizations to improve trash and illegal campsite cleanup efforts. Illegal campsite cleanup efforts. That's newspeak, Orwellian doublespeak for sweep away homeless people in the survival campgrounds that are the only ones that they have because there's no other shelter. It sounds much worse when you put it that way, if you hear it that way, but that's what they're talking about. And expand regional cooperation with Santa Cruz County and other agencies to address underlying public safety issues. Again, says the general, as I understand it, crimes of assault have dropped. Police stats tend to show a drop in crime rather than a rise in crime. I'm wondering about this. And again, I'm a little unclear about these stats. So if people have more information about this that they want to pass on to the community, that's great. Citizen, and the number to call here is 427-3772. City Council developed a citizen task force, which should represent the broader community and fully understanding public safety issues. In other words, more people meeting and chattering and chatting. Maybe it's not, there's no mention of laws to further criminalize, but I'm afraid that may come out of the blue from the city attorney's office sooner than we think. But again, I don't know for sure, and I don't want to be a paranoid person. That is item 15 on the City Council General Business Agenda, so you don't have to beg the permission of a council member to speak on the issue. You can actually talk about it, but maybe they'll give you a whole 2 minutes if Mayor Bryant is so inclined. Actually, she's required to do that. There is only an afternoon session. There is no evening session, it looks like, so there's a... This session will be at 3 o'clock on next Tuesday. So, let's see where we're at. Once more, a little music, and I'll be back. Yeah, that was Smiling Underneath from Red Letter Year, Ani DiFranco. You're tuned to Free Radio 101.3 FM. I'm Robert Norris. This is Bathrop's Piers Broadsides. Call-in number here, in case you have a mind to, is 427-3772. Here now is an interview with Steve Schnarr, who's, I mentioned earlier, he's involved with the bike church. He's been trying to negotiate a return of bikes to the bike church, and he talks about it. This is an interview from about a week ago at the Huff meeting.
So, June, but yeah, they changed the program over a year ago.
And so, Steve, as I understand it, you've been talking to the police department, trying to talk to the city manager or the assistant city manager, Tina Scholl, writing letters to Hillary Bryant, because the bikes apparently have been sent instead of to the bike church. They've been rerouted to another group called the Bike Dojo, yeah?
Yeah, they weren't coming to us. We were hosting a distribution program that was open to many groups, and we kept the kind of leftover junk. But and then those other groups were no longer participating either. But the Bike Dojo, which is a business that's a gym, also has a youth program. But the, they were not inviting all these other organizations in town, like Greenways to School and Barrios Unidos and the Bike Shack and different groups that used what Walnut Avenue's Women's Center. Nobody else was having access.
And I understand the Bike Dojo is also generally a for-profit approach, unlike the nonprofits and the bike church, and also has connections with one of the city council members?
Yeah, well, they're a business, and they have a youth program, which they say is charitable. It's not a registered nonprofit, but they have some collaboration with some of them. But all the other groups that used to participate had to provide documentation of nonprofit status. And yeah, we can't know for sure why everything changed, but it is true that one of the communications I got from the police said that it was made at the direction of city council, and then I asked, and then they said it was recommended by Hillary Bryant, and it does happen that her husband is friends with the owner of the Bike Dojo and works with them. There's not like a lot of money to be made off used bikes, and I don't think they have a financial interest, but it seemed more like their friends and the whole kind of network of people who are friends with each other, arranging things that are useful to each other, that seemed more of the concern. But
behind closed doors?
Yeah, that was a really bizarre aspect, because the bike church had this collaboration with the city for about 3 years, and there was never any problem or any claim that we were mismanaging the program, and then they suddenly changed it without even giving us a phone call or an email. And then when I tried to figure out what was going on, I got a bunch of, not very believable answers. So, they have some minor issues, so they never said, could we adjust the program? They just changed it without giving us notification, nor to any of the other groups who used to participate in the program. So
by changed it, you mean stopped all bike distribution to the bike church?
Yeah, well, the bikes were still going from the police to the community in some way, but it was only through this one business, which wasn't cooperating with all the other groups that used to get bikes, and they were selling some of them, which the city denied, and Don Lane has since admitted to me, and Tina Schull had confirmed that they were actually selling bikes in a way which violated the city code. But even though the Bike Dojo was mismanaging the program, the city seems committed to sticking with them. But we've been in this kind of gruelingly slow process of engaging with the bureaucracy, and it seems like it might happen in the next short period of time that there'll be a program which isn't exactly what happened before, but which is at least once again open to all the nonprofits.
So, as I understand it, be right with you, Nina. You then attempted to get some documentation by asking for Hillary Bryant's communications with the Bike Dojo and other communications from the Bike Dojo back and forth, the police department, and you what happened with that?
Well, I asked for kind of like any public records having to do with the bike distribution program and communications between any city council member, and there was a weird thing where they like delayed it so they could ask me if I really wanted it all, and one city council member has so much, and maybe we could refine the search. And I said, no, I would want to see it all, and they they never got back to me, and then I was later confirmed that it was Hillary Bryant, and then she, who now claims that they were in a, they were private emails, that they weren't actually on the public record, and so that they weren't needing to be shared. And so that, you know, we didn't really, we kind of got stuck on that one months ago. They wouldn't share it. Our attempt to get it in the press pretty much got turned around on us, so I haven't really pushed on that particular thing. But it does seem like, aside from the issue of bicycles, it seems like we need to have some discussion about if public business is happening, shouldn't it be on public emails that are publicly accessible, and how do we know that this is the thing that I've had most concern of. Maybe it's true, and her claim is there were some innocent emails that had to do with being a member of the gym, but it's like, well, how do we know if when I ask for a public document, it's not already on the record? A city staff person asks the city official, and they can share it. And if, and then they're the, and so where's the safeguard that they're actually sharing it? That's what I am concerned about.
And in fact, some city council members in the past 10 years have had set up separate private emails whereby they have communications with members of the community that they shield from any Public Records Act requests. And I asked Hillary Bryant, I had a meeting with her on Monday, and I asked her if she was doing this, and she said, no, every public, well, she said every publicly relevant document she would make available. She really didn't clarify whether she opened up her, she had one email stream that she simply directed people to on public business. And she said instead, however, that she had over 30 emails regarding this particular issue at the Bike Dojo that she would, that she had already sent to you, Steve. And I said, as far as I know, you hadn't gotten them. And that, is that accurate?
No, I have never got any of those emails.
And so then I asked her to send them, you know, forthwith, because maybe there was a mistake. And she said she would. And, of course, it's been only 2 days. And you, of course, gotten a flood of emails from...
Well, I have to write her personally. But I would say, Robert, that probably every public official will have a private account. If they're, like, emailing their spouse to say, what are we having for dinner? It doesn't need to be on the public record. So the issue is not whether or not somebody has this as a private email, but how do we know that they're limiting all public business onto the publicly accessible ones, which is, as far as I could tell, there's not really any safeguards. It seems like you have to ask the person, and they can choose or not to share it with you, and no one knows other than they do whether they had it to share in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, more than that, city council members I've talked to in the last 10 years, as I said, who have these emails, such as Ryan Coonerty, former city council member, have said, we have no obligation to share that with the public. That's a private email, period, whether it concerns public business or not. And so they seem to not just say, we can pick and choose which ones and we'll give you the public ones, but we don't even have to give you the public ones if they're sent on the private emails. And I also asked the city staff to tell me who has private emails which they direct people to send their public information to, and I couldn't get a straight answer from them in the last couple years on that issue, though previously they did. They gave me, I think it was 4 city council members who had those, or and 3 who didn't, and so it's changed that way. I again am hoping to get these emails from Hillary Bryant, who said she would send them out because she's claimed she'd sent them before. It could be the city staff and the city attorney are interfering in some way. It's not her fault. But I have sent her a series of emails starting in September that she has not responded to at all after the initial email. In fact, I've requested all her public emails, every single one, and I haven't gotten one public email. And I cannot believe that she has not had at least one public email in the last year. So that's the situation as far as I know.
Yeah, and as far as I'm concerned, you know, at this point, we're not focusing on that because we still don't really know whether or not or how much Hillary Bryant was particularly responsible. It's possible that what they claim now is that the police, oh, well, that wasn't very clear wording that they used, and it seems entirely possible that it was the police who didn't want us to be getting the bikes, because Tina Scholl said at the first meeting that she finally had after many months with us that she said as much. She said,
Tina Scholl is the assistant city manager.
She told us, we went through all these supposed reasons which didn't really hold water and which we could have modified the program easily if they'd asked us about it. And then she says at the end of the meeting, oh, well, there's a more fundamental issue, which is that and then she had this whole idea that the police weren't welcome at the bike church, which what she really is saying in other words is that because we're next door to Sabrosa, which is separated by a fence and is its own place, you know, and that they have kept the police out, that like they don't want to cooperate with somewhere else operating on the same property as part of a community center. So that was so at this point, for all I know, it's true, and that the police was trying, you know, either one of them, somebody's not giving me a straight answer, and I don't know whether it came from Hillary Bryant or from the police, so I don't want to go harping on her at this point in without full information.
Mm-hmm. I don't mind harping on her. Because I feel she's now obviously derelict not providing her emails, even on the public account. But I also wanted to point out, I met with Micah Posner, city council member, who I asked what's going on with this. He became secretive in the past, saying he would only answer to the bike church because you were the guys that he would run things past. And I said, what about other community members concerned? Well, he said he's not, you know, you are the community as far as he's concerned. Apparently we're not. Again, I don't know. He may come and speak about this himself. I've invited him to come to numerous Huff meetings. He so far hasn't chosen to attend. Full disclosure, he's a friend of mine. We play games together of card games, and we're not. But I am very demanding of council members, particularly those who are friends, but certainly as council members. He said that there was a draft report that Tina Scholl had prepared, a draft agreement about changes in the bike policy, but he would not say what those were, which I think is bad. I think the community needs to know what the draft proposal is. He said that he didn't want to interfere with the negotiations. And I said, well, the police department is holding up on the bikes. They have for a year. They didn't tell them initially. They aren't giving us straight information. It seems to me you want to publicize this or at least get it changed. And he said, well, he thinks that's in the process of happening. I think you got some sort of similar report.
Well, yeah, I've seen the draft. I was supposed to have a meeting, but then it's got delayed again. So I don't really know. Seems like there are times for things to be public, and there's. But it's not going to be. It's a proposal, and Dawn Lane has told me. You know, it's not like Tina is making the decision. She's making a proposal, and it could be reviewed by the council. So it seems appropriate that if it's not even been brought to a meeting of the interested parties, then if it's not public yet, that's fine. It will be public for some, as long as it's public for some point before it's actually decided. If the internal process is in the middle, that, you know. But I have seen it, and it's not that great. But it's better. Like I said, it's better than what it was. There's no point in going into the details because I haven't even actually had a chance to sit down and talk to her about it. And I'm one of the interested.
You wouldn't want to spearhead or pillory the negotiations and spear them in midstream, after all.
I don't feel like they're going that well, but it's just, like I said, I mean, the basic thing, yes, it would be open again to nonprofits, and some of the details.
Via the bike dojo or via the bike church?
Through the bike dojo. But hey, I got to go back to work, Robert, but thanks for having me.
Okay, and we've been talking with
Steve Snar.
Thanks, Steve. Steve is with the bike church.
That was an interview last Wednesday before last at the Huff meeting. You sometimes get some interesting stuff at the Huff meeting. I invite you to come. Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. Huff meets every Wednesday, 10 o'clock at 703 Pacific. The Sub Rosa, which police officers are not welcome. It's true. Although the bike church is next door, and they're welcome there, and they're welcome everywhere else. In fact, you can't keep them out. So, you know, this is... I'm a little worried that Steve Schnarr is doing his own bit of political patty cake here. But, you know, he's also quite candid in many other respects, so I appreciate his being open. And I will look to get a copy of that report to see what the story is with this situation, so that the community and not just the few insiders who negotiate for all of us without telling us what's going on or checking back with us, do their good work. So I'm going to actually give a call to Steve Plaich, who may or may not be available. I haven't seen too much of him, and I've been kind of, as I say, under the weather, still am. And perhaps you can give us a report on some of the needle schmiedel that's going on. And maybe not. Who knows? We'll see if he's even picking up this evening. In any case, we're soon going to go into this John Malkin's Great Leap Forward interviews around the Santa Cruz 11, which probably make interesting listening, although...
Your call has been forwarded to an automatic voice message system.
Steve Plaich.
And it sounds like we don't have a Steve Plaich.
He's not available.
So, we will leave that for another time. I'll be back on Sunday, hopefully feeling better. And if you want to reach me between times, you can call the Huff line, 423-HUFF, 423-4833. And I will try to get back to you or even answer the phone if I'm up to it. Excuse me. So that is that for now. And let's turn now to my relief, John Malkin, a rebroadcast of last night's interviews.
You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.3 FM and freakradio.org. My name is John Malkin. This is The Great Leap Forward. And here's a special update on Santa Cruz 11. On November 30th, 2011, during the height of the National Occupy Movement, protesters arrived at a vacant bank in downtown Santa Cruz located at 75 River Street. And people entered the building apparently with a key. And folks occupied the property for about 3 days. Initially, police arrived at the scene and then left. And according to witnesses, hundreds of people went in and out of the bank during those 3 days, some of them attempting to set up a community space, a place for homeless to sleep, a place for workshops, while others went into the vacant bank to party. After 3 days, on December 2nd, all of the demonstrators left and police retook the building. In February of 2012, 11 people were charged in association with the occupation of the vacant Wells Fargo Bank in downtown Santa Cruz. Many of them are well-known activists in town. In February, preliminary hearings began for all 11 of the individuals, and charges were eventually dismissed against Ed Rector and Grant Wilson in April of 2012. And according to Alex DeRossi, who is a journalist with Indy Media, who himself had charges dismissed in this case, he writes in a January 10th, 2013 piece that at a preliminary hearing on January 8th, holds were removed on three community members who were charged in association with the 75 River Bank occupation in Santa Cruz. All of the charges against Desiree Foster, Robert Norse, and Becky Johnson have been effectively dismissed by Santa Cruz Judge Paul Burdick. Charges still remain in effect for four defendants, Brent Adams, Franklin Angel Alcantara, Gabriela Ripley Phipps, and Cameron Larendau. And the judge also removed conspiracy charges from those people who remain with charges against them. For more information about this case, check out santacruz11.org. Currently, the next court dates happening in this case will be on February 1st, 2013 at 8:15 in the morning, and that's an arraignment for Cameron. March 11th, 2013 will be a motion to dismiss, and May 13th, 2013 is scheduled to be the beginning of the trial for the four who remain of the Santa Cruz 11. For more information, check out santacruz11.org. The interviews you're about to hear are with three of the original Santa Cruz 11, Robert Norse, Becky Johnson, and Brent Adams. On January 8th, 2013, charges were dropped against Robert Norse and Becky Johnson, and Brent Adams continues to face charges against him for the 2011 occupation of a vacant bank in downtown Santa Cruz.
Well, Judge Burdick dismissed all charges against three of us, but against the four remaining defendants, against whom there was no direct evidence whatsoever of them having caused any damage. There was one piece of evidence that one officer testified that Angel, Franklin Alcantara, moved a camera, one of the surveillance cameras, but no evidence that he damaged it. There was evidence that there was damage in the building later, but there was no evidence that any of the four still charged did any damage. The only evidence that existed was that they were in the building. There was some confusing evidence as to whether they were adequately warned or not. But what Burdick ended up doing, he dropped the conspiracy charges against everyone because he said there was no agreement that could be shown. However, you can still get a felony, a vandalism charge, if he claims, although this is disputed by the attorneys, and I think it's common sense to dispute it too, but the law doesn't really admit such a thing as common sense. Is that if you engage in an illegal action and can be shown that it is a natural and either I think it's natural and likely or maybe natural and inevitable, something like that, consequence of that illegal action, that other things happen that you don't do, that others do, even people you know nothing about, that somehow you can be charged with the damages they've done. That's the theory, so-called aiding and abetting theory, behind the four felony vandalism charges that are now part of the two charges that each of the remaining defendants, Gabriella, Angel, Brent, and what the other one is?
Cameron.
And Cameron Orando, right, are charged with. Thank you. But it's based, as I was telling you a moment ago, on a rather peculiar theory. There were originally two trespass charges against each of us. One of them was trespass and refusal to leave after being told by the owner's agent to leave. And the other was trespass and occupation of a property. And since this was supposed to be an occupation, according to some of the people who did it, though not necessarily according to any of the activists who are being charged, I don't think any statements are introduced by the activists in court that stated that they were occupying the property at any time. So there's no, as far as I know, there's no direct evidence that has so far been presented that that's the case. That it was an occupation certainly was asserted by numerous people in that building and, you know, I think on their website and to the media. But there was none, that didn't come from any of the remaining defendants. So there, but yet there, and they were, and of course they weren't charged with occupation. That charge was dropped. Instead, what I think, it almost seemed like Judge Burdick was trying to present a face to the media or the public to kind of explain his rather tortured rationale for holding somebody to blame, for God's sake, for the highly inflated estimate of $23,000 worth of damage that Wells Fargo claimed had, was required to clean up the graffiti and replace the furniture that had been damaged and the other furniture left by the protesters that had to be hauled away, all of which was done by out-of-the-county contractors, mm. It was pointed out finally at the hearing. So I mean, it seemed like the charges we suspect are over are inflated.
Mm-hmm.
But again, you know, I'm sorry, I'm kind of digressing. These charges that are left are felony vandalism, not because anybody vandalized anything, if they can prove that among those four defendants, because somebody else vandalized, and because these four defendants, they claim, likely violated another trespass law, not the occupy law, thou shalt not occupy somebody else's property, but thou shalt leave a piece of property when so informed by the owner's agent. Now, if you go through these defendants one by one, Cameron Lorando, the only time they have him in the building is when he's coming out of the building, he's told to leave, and he goes. So they would think that that doesn't really comport with the requirement that he violates the trespass law. If he doesn't violate the trespass law, he can't possibly be guilty of felony vandalism, because you have to violate that law in order to be accused of successfully aiding and abetting something which is a natural consequence of your violating that law, if you follow my gist.
I do. So it doesn't make sense that Burdick didn't also dismiss all charges against Cameron.
Well, none of these charges make any sense, as I think the very fine writer for the Good Times once showed this summer. You may remember him.
I think I remember that guy.
Yeah, cool guy. Also, I think his article was reprinted in the Street Spirit. But, you know, these charges are token charges, scapegoat charges, against a number of people who are peripherally involved in this occupation at best, some as reporters, some as liaisons, some people were there as observers, some supporters. But I don't know that there really are people who are at the center of this, who planned this whole thing, or even people who then are graffitied or did anything of that sort. They don't have any evidence. You would think that if they were serious about this, they would have evidence. I mean, you would think that they would send in one police agent to keep an eye on what's going on in the building and then afterwards testify. You know, I mean, there were so many people who didn't know each other in this occupation that it's surprising. It's hard to believe that they didn't have somebody in there, but none of that has come out at all. I'm not saying they did. I have no idea if they did. Also, you know, this is the sloppiest prosecution I've seen in my experience in Santa Cruz judicial history, and this is supposed to be a felony prosecution. They have one inexperienced, fumbling, and just pathetic, and I'm not trying to be mean to her, that's just my experience of her, assistant district attorney Rebecca Young, who is facing, first she was facing 11 attorneys, now she's facing 7 attorneys, and they generally don't give her any help. The only time they actually sent in help was on August 20th, when the question became, is the district attorney's office guilty of misconduct, which, of course, they don't want to be successfully accused of. So she's been, you know, the idea that she can handle all these cases when she has repeatedly, not just according to my account, not just according to the defense attorney's repeated testimony, but according to the judge's orders, been in violation of orders to provide the defense with the evidence that they need to defend the case, and still is, by the way. That came out again at the most recent hearing on Monday and Tuesday. She had declined to provide video, for example, a very key bit of video. Maybe it's there, and I haven't seen it, but I don't see it, and my attorney hasn't seen it, and I don't think Dan Climo, Becky Johnson's attorney, had seen it. The video that was taken that shows the police assault on the building, the video that shows the police assault on the line of people and the batons that came up, and supposedly the coffee that got thrown on one police officer, all that really key stuff is missing from the discovery. That I, as far as I know, I would double-check this with other people to be sure, John, but that's my understanding. And that's politically a very significant omission, not to have it. It may not be terribly legally important, but if you claim you're providing all the discovery and you don't give that, and it exists because it was testified to under penalty of perjury by, I think it was Officer Headley, that his colleague Officer Williams, two officers who were in a car on the levee filming and then later crossed the street to film more directly. If you don't provide that, it can be gross negligence, it can be intentional, who knows what it is. Mm-hmm. It's just, this whole case is just very, very, very sloppy. And seems to suggest that maybe Lee's making these token efforts. He gave it to the weakest assistant district attorney he could find. Lee kind of palmed it off on her, saw that she was in trouble, ignored her troubles. And it's just sort of, you know, and of course Judge Burdick is doing everything he can to hold her by the hand and tell her it's okay. You probably were familiar with, I don't know, you probably read what I wrote about how outrageous Burdick's decision is not to give real sanctions against Rebecca Young to the defense. First, they should be dropping the entire case based on the failure to provide discovery, but he refused to do that back in August. Then he should have held stronger sanctions immediately thereafter, but he postponed it until January. January comes around, he doesn't offer any evidentiary sanctions, and when two attorneys say that they've spent $5,000 to $7,000 in expenses solely and obviously and what has been shown to be the misconduct or negligence of Rebecca Young and not providing discovery, so they have to keep coming down again and again, spend more and more time just trying to get the same discovery that they was originally asked for in February, and they don't get until, and still don't get by January, but they mainly get in August, that that's $5,000 to $7,000 for at least two attorneys. And what does the judge say? Oh, I can't do that because if I gave a sanction of more than $1,000, that would go to the Bar Association and would look bad for Rebecca Young. I mean, come on. I mean, this is a form of corruption and collusion that is pretty intense and pretty overt.
He actually said that in court? That was the reason for not going so high?
Yeah, he said he did not. He felt it was not serious enough. He would not allow the Bar Association to receive that kind of a complaint because he did not feel it was appropriate for Rebecca Young to be sanctioned in that way. Also scandalous, and this reflects on my own attorney and every single one of those seven defense attorneys, they also refused to make complaints to the Bar Association about it. So, you know, you might get a different story from them.
Yeah.
But, I mean, when I demanded of my attorney that he do it, he said, oh, I've got other cases where they've done worse. And I said, I don't give a shit about the other cases. This is very clearly $5,000 to $7,000 worth of damage for you. You need to be recompensed, and so does the other attorney. And the district attorney's office needs to be sanctioned so it doesn't do this to the next person.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly it needs to be brought out, even if the complaint is not successfully, you know, upheld. It has to be addressed, at least presented. None of these attorneys will. There's this attorney privilege. That's the only way I can see that it really is happening. I mean, maybe I'm misunderstanding in some way, but I was upset with my attorney because he wouldn't do this.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting to hear, Robert, because some of the mainstream reports about this are describing it from a totally opposite angle of it's really rare for a judge to bring sanctions on the DA, and wow, isn't this quite a significant thing? I think $500 is what he was demanding.
True, but what judge would tolerate this kind of shit for hearing after hearing in this whole matter, and then month after month? And in other words, I'm sure that statement is true in a certain way, but in another sense, it is simply not proportionate to the damage done. In my view, again, I'm a lay person on this. And, you know, it would behoove you if you're writing a story about it to, you know, get some other people's perspectives.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's, you know, I mean, of course, you also got to back up to look at the broader picture, which is this, you know, may well be a part of a much broader attack on the Occupy movement and political organizations.
Mm-hmm.
Willingness to engage in direct action of a peaceful sort.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it has to be pointed out that there was, in spite of all the blather about rocks on the roofs and coffee on the cop and all this, that there were, according to, I've heard, there were four injuries of activists. I still haven't been able to get the specifics about it. I think it was either Brent or someone else who had that, came up with that figure. Four people were injured. I don't know what you researched this a bit yourself, so you may know more about it. But, you know, we have a situation where there are vacant bank buildings. There were five of them around Santa Cruz up to retail very recently. I think one of them is now reoccupied by a bank on ocean or water. I'm not sure for sure. But you have people freezing at a high almost death rate. You have massive foreclosures. I'm not telling you anything you don't know, but it's so obvious. And so blatant. And instead of any kind of attempt to, well, I mean, I think this seems to me to be a clear substitute for addressing any of these actions. I mean, I don't think the people at the, you know, in positions of power sat down and say, how can we avoid addressing these actions? They determine they're not going to address these actions because, you know, wouldn't know where to begin, and they're not interested in doing it, really. And they're, you know, it would challenge their positions of power and prestige anyway to start with. And who knows where it would lead. But for the rest of us, for the majority of people out there who are faced
faced with real foreclosures, you get this phony debate about private property going on. The idea that somehow a vacant bank is equivalent to, you know, somebody's hearth and home is so clearly preposterous that it just makes me grimace every time I read about it and the troll talk on the topic from the Sentinel, you read the Sentinel stories about this. And, of course, that's the whole rationale, I think, behind this prosecution, because they're mobilizing sentiment in the community against activists, particularly using the vandalism angle, where, you know, oh, they're going to come in and vandalize your house. Of course, you won't be having a house once Wells Fargo gets done with you, but that point is not even discussed, or it's not even in the public eye. Sorry if I'm straying a little bit here.
No, it's fine. Tell me about yesterday and being in the courtroom and Burdick. How did Burdick dismiss the charges against you, and how did you feel when that happened?
He wasn't sure if he was going to dismiss the charges against me. He was sure he was going to dismiss the charges against Beck. He used a simple criteria. Again, he was looking for a way to sort of, I think, explain it to the community or maybe explain it to himself, which was, unless there was evidence that you had been warned after the point at which Wells Fargo actually authorized the police to clear the area, which wasn't until, it's not clear when it was, but there was no evidence presented until it was after dark. Hmm. And there was no evidence presented that anybody was warned before dark, after dark. But he took it as evidence if anybody was in the building after that. I think Cameron was in the building and came out and left and told to go. Gabriella was not in the, I'm straying. Do you want me to go back to your question or continue with this?
That's fine.
Gabriella, well, they've never shown she was in the building with any direct evidence in that particular set of hearings, but they did show that she came to the police station and offered to try to be a liaison. She contacted them by phone when they told, she said, this is what they're saying, you know. So the police essentially asked her to take the message to the group inside that they had to leave and that they were going to be forced out. And what kind of an exit strategy could they use, et cetera, et cetera. She agreed to communicate all this, but in no time were they ever able to place her in the building. Burdick didn't care. He said, that doesn't matter. She's a part of the group. She's the liaison. She's a spokesperson for the group. She denied that. There was no real evidence she was a spokesperson for the group. She simply offered to be an intermediary.
Hmm.
Other people who were intermediaries, like Steve Plaich, like Paul Johnston, who were seen in the building. But again, you know, they were never even charged. But of course, hopefully now they would not ever be charged, nor would many of the others, many of whom I know and you know, and the police should know by just looking at some of those videos, because they were... they were going in and out of the building before dark. And that's the point at which, the cutoff point at which Burdick essentially used to describe when a person became guilty of, there became not guilty of violating the trespass law, but there was persuasive reason to take the case to trial.
Mm-hmm.
The suspicion that she or he might be violating that. Warned to leave and didn't go trespass law. So for me, what the judge said was, I was about to present a defense witness testifying to the fact that I'm a journalist, that I write and that I do radio and all that stuff. And we were about to do that, and Verdi interrupted us and said, hold it. He says, I have to go through all this. But to give you a little bit of the dramatic background, this is about 3 o'clock, he said this, but about noon before we broke for lunch, he kind of came out with a kind of frightening assertion, saying, it's clear Miss Ripley Phipps was involved in all this. We don't have to show she was in the building. It's obvious she was a part of all this. Again, this is Burdick's assertion. That Burdick's a great liberal judge that we're so happy about, and I'm not. We came back to the court at 1:30 thinking, we're all screwed. We're all going to be charged. He says, you know, he's going to find there's reason to believe we were all warned, therefore we're all guilty of felony this or felony that, you know, or there's at least reason to take this to trial. However, he decided, he said, well, he told Rebecca Young, you either have to come up with some evidence that these people have been warned. I'm inclined to dismiss charges against, I'm not sure about Mr. Norris, but Ms. Johnson and Ms. Foster, there's no evidence been presented that they were in the building after they were warned. He neglected to say there was also no evidence that the others were in the building after they had been warned.
Mm-hmm.
He asserted that fact. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was evidence presented that that Angel was actively involved in. He was sort of on top of the furniture barricade and stuff of that sort. And there was evidence that Brent brought out some trash cans and put them in front of the building again before the warning.
Mm.
I think there may have been evidence that he came out at some point later. He said, Miss Young, you must come up with some evidence. Young came back and went through this, her usual very, I don't know how much of these trials you've actually, these hearings you've seen. She goes into these elaborate, she uses a lot of words, not answer questions that are put to her. At least that's my perception of her. And she said, well, I have to agree with Your Honor that the aiding and abetting theory cannot really apply to Mr. Norris. No, she seemed to be backtracking. And unlike in the previous dismissals, if you will, she did not say she was going to recharge us, which is good. I like that.
Mm-hmm.
I felt guilty, however, coming out of this trial, and I felt upset because there are four people who are still being tried. I don't want to waste my time on this fucking shit. I think it's a waste of all our time, and it's also. I don't know. I'm not the closest bosom buddy to all these folks, but they're being hurt by this. It's emotionally draining. It's creating a financial burden. I mean, it's all been discussed, I think, in some of the Patch stories, which you probably read, on the Sentinel stories, even the more recent ones. The impact on Becky Johnson's credentials is no longer going to be. At least she gets to go try and get her teaching credential.
Yeah.
Barely holding on to her housing. I mean, it's an economic crisis for a lot of people. And I don't know what the situation is. Brent and, I don't know if you can put it in the story. You should check with them. But, Brent and Angel live in their vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
They're on the edge. They may be sleeping illegally every night. I mean, it's all, it's a gruesome kind of situation. And it's also kind of, Alice in Wonderland quality to it, because it has nothing to do with any real crimes and any real public interest, and it also takes some really good activists out of the community, and I keep hoping we'll find ways to turn this around in some way, like Keith McHenry, his suggestion was to go occupy some banks. His suggestion was to mobilize the community and stop foreclosures. This community was, in other words, return the focus to the issues.
Mm-hmm.
What's really happening in the community. But that's easier said than done, and it's easier to do it in a big city where people are actually, you have some people who are not afraid, and you have some people who feel more secure and are more militant in what they're doing. In Santa Cruz, people are, we had one large demonstration at the real Wells Fargo Bank across the street after this happened in mid-February, which you probably remember.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you don't, but it was covered very well by Alex DeRosi
mm-hmm.
and Bradley. And not really anything else. I mean, there have been some marches. The Brown Berets did a great march, and there have been some small benefits, but there has not been a real, people have not been pursuing foreclosures, and the foreclosures haven't stopped.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's even documenting them. So, it's kind of grim. I'd like to say it's a victory, and sure it is. I feel much better the last couple of days myself, yesterday and today, that is, because now I can, I just feel better. It's like some kind of weight has been lifted. But I'm aware it's not really necessarily lifted. I can be recharged.
That was Robert Norris, whose charges were dropped against him for any wrongdoing in the occupation of a vacant bank in downtown Santa Cruz.
There are still four people left who face charges in this case, including Brent Adams. Now you'll hear from Becky Johnson.
Tell me what happened yesterday in court. It's almost a year since being charged, yeah?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was actually physically arrested on February 8th. And then Judge Burdick ruled that there was insufficient evidence to charge me with any of the four counts I was charged with yesterday on January 8th. So exactly 11 months after I was arrested, I was cleared of all those charges. So that was 11 months of living with, these charges hanging over my head, ordered to obey all laws, meaning that if I was picked up for something like jaywalking or chalking or anything, really, the police could just take me to jail, and I could sit in jail until my preliminary hearing. And that was the kind of shadow I was living under this whole time.
Hmm. How did you feel when he dismissed the charges against yourself and Robert and Desiree?
Well, I certainly felt vindicated because my position all along has been that I was not part of the planning of that particular action. And my participation was more as a kind of a bit of a cheerleader outside. I did hold a sign. I did blog about it. I thought it was a really favorable thing for these people to do. It's a little bit more than I would have done myself. It takes a lot of balls to move into a vacant bank building. I certainly could understand the reasons why that particular group of activists chose to do that particular action.
When I read the police reports last year, they implied in there that Grant had been identified by a citizen, not a police officer, and kind of turned into the police. And in your writings, you have implied that you were identified by someone. What? Tell me about that part of all this.
I was identified by only Officer William Winston of the Santa Cruz Police Department. I was outside of the building. I wasn't hiding. I didn't have a mask. I really didn't believe I was breaking any laws or had any reason to hide. The police had videotape of me outside the building, which ironically they opted not to play it in court. I was a little surprised by that, but since the video shows me going over and having a conversation with Catherine Byers, perhaps they felt that would bring Catherine Byers into the record and that could be a boon for the defense because of a selective prosecution argument. Since Catherine Byers on the city council was not being prosecuted. In fact, I had planned to call Catherine Byers as a witness at my trial, should I be bound over to trial, so that we could, did you see Becky on that day? Yes. Did you go inside the building? Yes. Did Becky follow you? No. And that would be a pretty good witness for me, I hoped. Mm. Obviously, that won't be necessary now that I'm not facing any charges.
Oh, that's great. I'm really happy for the three of you that that's happened. And it's also...
I'm especially happy for Desiree. Mm. She was the youngest of the Santa Cruz 11. She took it so hard. There was that suicide attempt shortly after she was charged. And, young people do take things very hard sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Uh, So, you know, for her to be free, I'm just thrilled about that.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope, although there is a bit of a damper that, according to my attorney, I could be the district attorney can refile charges on any of us up to 3 years after the original incident. So that means, you know, I've got almost 2 years ahead of me where suddenly one day the DA could file the charges against me and we could go through it again.
That's crazy. And that actually did happen with Franklin and Cameron, yeah?
Exactly. They were, Judge Burt, the same judge, you know, said that dropped all the charges against them because said there was no case. Young refiled against the two of them. She did not refile against Grant Wilson or Ed Rector. And now both Cameron and Angel are, you know, facing, are going to be facing trial now.
It's weird. I spoke with Robert a little while ago, and he's, even though he has plenty to say about all this, he is, partly what he's saying is it's a shame we're spending any time at all on all of this because there's other more important things to do. And it's bizarre trying to figure out what is the logic behind who's charges are being dismissed and whose are not, and are they just wanting to hold someone responsible? It's a little weird.
Well, I thought that when they charges were dropped against Robert North, the big fish got away. I can't prove this, but I kind of thought that the animosity that the police or certain people in the city have against Robert North, but they wanted to get him in particular and maybe charged a bunch of other people around to make it look not quite so personal. But you can hear on some of the police tapes that were taken on November 30th that they're just keeping traces. They're just saying Robert Norris, like, over and over and over again on it. Well, there's Norris. What's he doing? When there were, 75 to 100 people that they were observing, to pick him out that way as being, you know, that they were out to get him. I couldn't put that aside, but that might have been one of the motivations.
Mm-hmm.
Another motivation might be that Bob Lee was being very much pressured by Downtown Business Association interests, perhaps by Wells Fargo itself, that they needed to prosecute somebody for that. That they couldn't just let that anyone people get away with that. Another theory is that Bob Lee took it as an opportunity to take out some of his enemies, people who have been a little critical against him in the past or have caused him trouble. And the reason that we wonder that is because the way he went after alternative journalists such as Bradley, Alan Stewart, or Alex DeRossi, Robert Norris, or myself, you know, the four of us were all alternative journalists, but he didn't go after the Patch reporters, he didn't go after the Sentinel. Phil Gomez with KSBW reportedly tried to get into the building and was repelled by the people inside. I didn't try to get in the building, you know, and yet that was not held against him, and basically it seemed as though because I was writing things that were positive about the action, where these other journalists were maybe focusing on the sanctity of private property had been violated, or that people were just a bunch of lawbreakers and miscreants and vandals and hoodlums, and they had that angle. Those kind of journalists, even if they went in the building, were not sanctioned in any way or facing any charges. So that was another theory. I don't really know. All I know is that the prosecution and the judges and the court all got paid through this process, where the defendants did not, and some of the attorneys were. I know my attorney was working for public defender wages, and I know $100 an hour sounds like a lot of money, but for an attorney, it's not. And that's what the district attorney's office gave. Thankfully, I was able to get a pretty good attorney who worked very vigorously on my behalf. Yeah. But I'm not sure that everybody could have that same luxury.
Mm-hmm. That was Becky Johnson, one of the Santa Cruz 11, whose charges have been dismissed now. There remain four people in Santa Cruz with charges being held against them for their relationship to the occupation of a vacant bank downtown. One of them is Brent Adams, who you will hear from now. So, today is the 10th of January, 2013. 2 days ago, you were in court again for the occupation case. How many times do you think you've been to court since February 2012?
No, somewhere between 10 and 15, because I had to try to get a lawyer disqualified, and that didn't happen. So we were in hearings about that. The judge refused to have my lawyer dismissed. Do you want me to hold it, or? Finally, my lawyer did quit early on. Then I had to keep coming back to try to get a new one, and no one would accept the case. So that was like three or four court dates right there, and then several starts, what they call readiness, that didn't happen, and then several beginnings to preliminary hearings that didn't happen, and now these 2 days. Somewhere between 10 and 20 visits probably. I'm not sure how many. It's a lot.
Yes, it's a lot. And I know that it's been stressful and weird. I suppose it has been.
Yeah. Then there's the Santa Cruz 11 meetings. We've had support meetings. But they became increasingly less supportive, and then we just kind of stopped them until we fired them up again recently because we had a benefit that you attended.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, it has definitely been life change. It's affected my life in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. It's true.
Mm-hmm.
Stress. I'm dealing with the stress really good now, though.
Mm.
But I have my bad days, that's for sure.
Mm. Mm. I wish the whole thing was finished. And tell me about what happened on Tuesday. Over time, Judge Burdick has dropped charges against people. There were seven people who went to court Tuesday. He dropped. Tell me what happened in court on Tuesday.
Well, he dropped. Of course, Becky Johnson is similar to, if you know the reference, the building number 7. Of this case, because if you look, you know building number 7, it's the one building in the World Trade Center that wasn't hit by a plane, and it's the first building in history that has fallen by a side. So it's kind of like the weird smoking gun that it kind of shows some other story. And so she and I watched 20 to 30 hours of video footage, police footage, that I have access to. And 1,000 photographs. It's all police evidence. And it's clear that she probably was farther away from the actual doorway than anybody else on the premises, including Catherine Byers, who, when you watch the videos, she's in and out of the building. She actually dances to the music a little bit. She's slapping people on the back. She's definitely in everybody knows who she is, so I'm not going to say she's with the occupiers. But I can see why the police recommended her for charges. But it's bizarre why they would recommend Becky for charges, because she just intentionally stayed on the sidelines.
Yeah. So what do you think is the larger story of bringing her in?
I'll quickly finish that other question.
Yeah, sure.
So she definitely the prosecutor was unable to prove that they were there after they had been warned to leave. That seems to be the big thing with the judge.
Yeah.
Yes, they may have been in the building, but were they there after they were told to leave? And there's no evidence showing that Desiree Foster, who's I'm really happy because she was the media liaison and she was on the news a lot. She's very young. It affected her life quite a bit, depression and stuff. And then Robert and Becky, while they were there, and Robert was in the building many, many times, it's not yet. So. And then yesterday, well, 2 days ago, the conspiracy charge was dropped because of all the evidence that was brought up over the last those 2 days, Monday and Tuesday. There's no evidence of any kind to show that we had an agreement.
Mm.
It's just a march ended up there. The building, the doors were flung open. That's the biggest mystery. And then people started doing things, but there's no evidence to show anything happened before that. So that was really awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that they just kind of throw these charges on top of cases like this anyway. And it's up to the defense to try to attack those. And then he said one of the trespassing charges is more of like an occupation thing, like lodging or something. And he's saying it's clear that these people were there temporarily, so he took one of the trespassing. So now we're down to just one trespassing and vandalism. And then he said, if you're guilty of trespassing in this building, you're automatically guilty of vandalism. You're aiding and abetting.
Yeah.
And that's going to be the difficult thing for us in the future. My lawyer is trying to attack that with some other legal strategy. The precedent that he highlighted didn't seem to really make sense.
Mm-hmm.
No.
I agree. That is very bizarre, this. And they've talked about that for the whole trial process, this thing, if you're in there, then you're responsible for whatever happens in there. If there's a natural, likely possibility of that, I don't see how that's a natural or likely more than painting or redesigning the furniture or I don't know. Why is that likely that there would be vandalism?
Well, it's definitely something that the legal system is doing. He's results-oriented, I believe, and somebody will pay.
Mm.
And he seems to have a mechanism to get through this quickly. He just cutting it to the chase.
Mm.
These four people stayed there definitely multiple days. They were told to leave. And vandalism happened, so he's just trying to. I think he's just reducing it to this basic thing, but it's still pretrial. I think in the trial it'll be what's the term? Beyond a reasonable doubt or something.
Mm.
And I don't think it's going to be a slam dunk. I think that's just his. That was just a statement going in this direction. Now I think we'll have to prove vandalism or something. So we'll see.
Yeah. I don't know if I mentioned this to you in one interview I did with Rebecca Young. She told me that she was going to use as evidence of this theory that there were these signs written of rules when you're inside there. And one of them, no drugs, no alcohol, no vandalism, no spray painting. She was going to say that they must have known it was going to happen because they wrote that.
That's the argument they're using.
What?
If you thought that it might happen, that means you knew that it might be happening. Yeah, likelihood of it happening. And if you are, like I'm seeing, distributing garbage cans outside and putting plastic bags in them, and so I'm facilitating the action now, and I'm speaking on a couple of interviews, so I'm definitely, like, in a way, not responsible for the things, but I'm doing some sort of hosting behavior.
Right.
So that's what they're trying to say.
Right.
Like, if I knew that Ben Olsen was potential, and it's,
right.
I'm I don't know anything about the legal aspects of that. We hear silly anecdotes or metaphors like if your parents left and you had a house, and they had a house and you had a party over, and if it was damaged, you're kind of responsible. Something like that. But people, if the defendants were actively, you know, trying to maintain the building in a pristine condition and doing activism there, trying to bring attention to these the banking practices. While we were in the building or just prior, we had heard that was the $7 trillion Federal Reserve practically gift to the banks, and then they bought government-backed securities and then paid the Fed back immediately, and everyone made a shit ton of money.
Yeah.
And it didn't trickle down. So something like that, we're trying to bring attention to. Also the fact that there's no place for people to be outside when it's so cold. So while you're doing those, well, ostensibly, that's our messaging, our First Amendment messaging, vandalism wouldn't factor into any of it. It wouldn't be a natural component of any of that.
Yeah.
And then they looked at the vandalism, police evidence is public. I can't in the future. It showed the nature of the vandalism. A lot of it was moniker tags. People just doing their own little tags. Anarchist symbols, things like that. It wasn't a wholesale destruction of the surfaces, just in some key spots.
How did you feel when charges were dismissed against Becky and Robert and Desiree, and then some charges dropped against you, but you're continuing in this process?
I love to celebrate. First of all, that the charges against Becky were dropped, and then definitely Desiree, that she's out of the, she's free and clear. That's huge for me. So I love to celebrate. But Robert, you know, I want him to rot in a Turkish prison. So, you know, not really celebrate. I'm joking. That's it. No.
You can maybe talk to Burdick about that.
I love it. I mean, that's the reason it's awesome that Robert has his charges dismissed is because he's just this irritating element in our community. When I say irritating, that's effective. He's effective that way. You know, and it just gets under the police department's skin. I don't know if you saw the KION report last night. It's online. Deputy Chief Steve Clark just squirming. It's really insulting. I'm just like, yes. I'm really happy with
Desiree. I'm really glad too. In some ways, from my point of view, it seems like some weird slot machine, like who has their charges dropped and who doesn't. Does it make sense to you?
This all makes sense. The first guy, Ed Rector, he's all over the video, but like Becky, he's just staying outside. He's not known. The only reason he was brought in is because all of us is because those police officers in the first 2 hours recognized us. And there are plenty of other people that were that were there, but they just weren't easily recognizable. So this random guy, he's not an occupied Santa Cruz guy, not known as in the activist community. But I think it was clear that he wasn't seen inside the building or after the mornings. The two journalists, it's like some National Journalism Association went to bat for them and then ACLU. And so I think that actually had a lot to do with their getting out.
Yeah.
So we're charged with trespassing, and then we're charged with vandalism.
Yeah.
kind of vandalism, of course, everyone understands, is there's damage to surfaces or something's broken or something, right? So we all understand that, whoever owns the space or the item damaged is upset and wants, is trying to get that recouped. But what you have here is like $26,000 of a bill that includes everything, like $6,000 in furniture removal.
Yeah, yeah, I saw that.
And that's and then like $5,000 is labor.
Yeah.
So why would